I felt guilty about not having kept him company. How was the reception? It seemed like a success. He continued to study the book.
It was.
How was your speech?
Brilliant.
I took another sip of the communal coffee.
You're sounding pedantic.
He nodded and handed the book back to me.
I am now in cop mode.
You know, he watched me as I watched Katie. You may be going back to Wyoming alone. He continued studying me as I slipped the book back in the pack.
That is what you want?
I shifted in the chair. I just can't keep you here while I wait for... I could feel the heat rising in my face, so I took a few moments to swallow and let the warmth dissipate. I don't know when I'm going to be able to go home. He straightened in his own chair.
Maybe the wait will be shorter than you think.
He brought his large hands up and clapped the leather palms together like the report of a rifle with a voice that thundered from the high plains.
Katie!
I spilled the coffee. The head nurse was standing, but she remained behind the desk. She was probably afraid that the Indian was on the warpath. I turned back toward him with my face set, but when my eyes rested on Katie, hers were open. And they were not staring at the ceiling, but at us. I felt myself rising from my chair and walking toward the bed, and her eyes followed me. I couldn't breathe, and my vision was clouding with the pent emotion of what seemed like a lifetime. I had never seen eyes as beautiful as the ones I was looking into now. I reached out and took her hand with my battered, finger-guarded paw. "How long have you known?" He smiled and shook his head at my ignorance.
"Just now."
I was standing there looking at him when I thought I felt a mild pressure in my hand that a man without hope would have perceived as a reflex action. I turned and looked at Katie, and her eyes stayed steady with mine. I gently squeezed her hand in return, and once again, ever so gently, she squeezed back. I kneeled down by the bed, the tears stinging.
"I see you. I see you. And I felt that just now."
I stayed with those eyes, staying with him just as sure as I held onto her hand.
"Don't you go away. Don't you ever go away again."
She didn't nod or even move.
But I knew she could hear me and understand.
I squeezed her hand again, but she didn't squeeze back this time. And that was okay. She was probably tired. And we had a long way to go. It was Dr. Rissman's day off. Another surgeon from the floor below said that it was a cognitive effect that denoted a reactive concept, but not necessarily one of perceptivity. He started to give me the reactivity-perceptivity routine, but I refused delivery and told him the greatest legal mind of our time was on its way back, so get ready. The narrow rays of hope I'd been nurturing cracked across the ICU like the sound of Henry's hands, and I sat at the side of Katie's bed for the next hour and 43 minutes until her eyes closed again. They wanted to run more tests, and I was the thing that was holding them up. I didn't want to let go, and wanted to be there when her eyes opened again, but one of Henry's thunderclap hands rested on my shoulder, and I felt the tug of home from two mountain ranges away. I brushed the sleeve of my shirt across my face, smearing the residue of sentiment and careful to avoid the parts that were freshly stitched. I laughed.
"What is it?"
I tried stretching my shoulders without pulling at my beat-up Raggedy Andy head. I was just thinking that if my face was the first thing I saw when I came to, I might go back to sleep myself. I looked to see if she would respond when he dragged my hand away, but she didn't. Like Sleeping Beauty, she was enchanted again. And all I could do was wait. It was a beautiful day, and the warmth of the sun felt good on my back. Henry had picked the Vietnamese stir-fry place near the university for an early lunch, and the food was actually pretty good. The guy had almost dropped his spatula when the Indian ordered in Vietnamese. Since it was a Saturday, and the students were otherwise engaged, we occupied one of the picnic tables. My two regular pigeons hopped over and stood beside my boots. I motioned with my plastic spork. "Mutt, Jeff, meet Henry Standing Bear." Henry nodded at the two freeloaders.
"Aho, Mutt and Jeff."
Mutt cocked his head at the baritone Cheyenne, but Jeff kept his beady eyes on my fried rice. I looked toward the facade of Franklin Field and thought about what had happened today. I thought about the chain of violence and death that had been at least momentarily reversed. I thought about acts of kindness and acts of risk that were due a reward. Henry ate his shrimp with rice and looked at me but didn't say anything. He took a sip of his green tea and studied me with the steady, dark eyes.
"What do you think they will find at the medicine man statue?"
I took a deep breath, and it seemed like my ribs didn't hurt as badly. Now that I have had time to think about it, nothing.
Nothing?
I think William White Eyes was going to be there. I put my paper plate on the ground so that Mutt and Jeff could get a shot at some rice. He's not going to show for Philadelphia's finest, but he will for us. He sat the cup down.
"This is not over then, is it?"
"He saved Katie." He didn't reply. "You and I both know that if she hadn't gotten medical attention as quickly as she did, she'd be dead." It felt good having some idea of what I was going to do. He exposed himself not once but a bunch of times to make sure that we were okay. I used the finger guard to scratch at the stitches at my jaw. That's just not something I can walk away from.
Toy Diaz?
Has to be. The way I see it, Devin Conliffe tried to put pressure on Katie about the laundering scheme. But when she didn't bite, he was going to turn state's evidence on Osgood. Either Osgood or Diaz got antsy and decided to have Shankar Duval toss Devin off the Benjamin Franklin Bridge. But then Billy Carlyle became a loose cannon, and everybody decided they couldn't trust anybody.
You do not think that Shankar Duval was there at the academy to kill you?
No. It might have been what Diaz told Osgood or what Osgood planned with him, but I think Diaz had decided that Assistant D.A. Vince Oz Osgood was not the type to go down with the ship. Besides, Duval told me himself that he hadn't planned to kill me. I sipped my iced tea. Now, the only one left with any of the answers is Billy Carlyle, a.k.a. William Whiteeyes.
So you think it is our responsibility to keep him alive?
It's mine.
Then it is ours.
Our attention was drawn to a sassy brunette who was attempting to walk an oversized dog into the lobby of the University of Pennsylvania Hospital. Henry stuck both fingers in his mouth and whistled with a piercing note that rattled the surrounding window panes. Vic stopped arguing with the security guard, flipped him off, and crossed 34th without looking. Mutt and Jeff scattered in the presence of dog as Vic sat next to me and took my iced tea. She sat very close. "So, you got any other great ideas?"
"Nothing."
She held a few ice cubes in her mouth. "Nothing."
"We're the cops."
There was a possible toy sighting up in Germantown, where a competitor in the highly volatile commerce of grassroots pharmaceutical distribution came down with a critical case of NFP. We continued to look at her. No fucking pulse.
"Did this competitor fall off a bridge?"
"No bridge is big enough in Germantown." She shook her head and continued crunching the ice between her teeth. "Somebody ran over him with a car. Twice." Henry and I looked at each other, and then I looked back at Vic. "I want to go up to the medicine man and have a look for myself. Or have William Whiteeyes have a look at us." I remembered Nina's invitation as I looked at her. "Your mother and father invited us over for dinner." Vic choked, picked up the cup again, and began eating more ice. "Yeah, tell him I'll pencil him in." Henry watched her for a few moments.
They say chewing ice is a sign of sexual frustration. Vic slipped her hand on my knee under the table, and I almost jumped off the bench. She continued chewing.
I wouldn't know about that.
Four hooves down means that the individual died in battle.
I looked at the four bronze horse hooves planted firmly in the granite base. I thought died in battle was one hoof lifted. Vic held dog and input her 2 cents. What are 2 hooves lifted? I glanced down at the description in the book. You mean rearing? Yeah. I looked around. Fell off his horse during battle? The sloping lawn of this part of Fairmount Park was at odds with the sordid squalor across Ridge Avenue. The row houses on the block were falling apart from the neglect, and the only retail establishment was an after-hours club in what looked to have been a restaurant. I turned back to the statue and read from the book. Cyrus E. Dallin, 1861 to 1944. He was from Utah. The bear moved a little closer to the statue, but seemed distracted and looked at an area to the southwest. Famed Native American scholar Francis LaFleche described the nudity of the holy man, typifying the utter helplessness of man in comparison to the strength of the Great Spirit, whose power is symbolized by the horns upon the head of the priest. The Cheyenne Nation walked past me.
Looks like a high five.
I glanced up, and it did. What now?
Well, while we're waiting for William White Eyes, we look for a note.
We looked for 15 minutes. No note. Vic was sitting on the hillside looking at the book of statuary, and Dog had decided to join her. Henry and I were still searching the surrounding trees in hopes that the wind might have caught the note and landed it on a branch, but it still found nothing.
It is not here.
I'm beginning to think you're right. We walked back over and stood in front of Vic, and Henry asked,
"Is this the only medicine man?"
She placed a hand across the open page and looked up. "Yes."
I shrugged.
"I guess we might as well head back to the hospital." Henry had parked the Thunderbird across Edgeley Street. We made our way to the car when I noticed a tricked-out, fully chromed Escalade, bristling with oversized wheels, brush guards, and enough off-road lights to illuminate the Miracle Mile. It was stopped at a discreet distance, and I was thinking about William White Eyes when the tinted-windowed vehicle made a casual U-turn and thrummed its way back toward the reservoir and the depths of Fairmount Park. If you were an Indian in the city, where would you hide? I held out my hand to Henry as we watched the Escalade disappear behind the sloping green of Athletic Field. Give me your keys.
Why?
I started around the car toward the driver's side and tossed the day pack into the back seat, feeling the weight of my .45 inside. You drive too slow. He stopped and looked genuinely hurt.
I do not.
Give them to me. He handed me the gold-colored anniversary keys that he had put on the Lucky Rabbit's foot chain. Vic quickly climbed in the back with Dog, and Henry took shotgun.
Do not wreck Lola.
In the rearview mirror, I watched as Vic put her arm around Dog. I'll try not to. I fired up the 430-cubic-inch police interceptor and began intercepting. Fortunately, we were parked in the right direction, so I gunned her and quickly motored across the hill, following the only road the Cadillac could have taken. At Fountain Green Drive, we had to make a decision. Vic hung over the seat and pointed left. Stay on the reservoir road. He'll either double back or continue the loop back up 33rd. She was right. We turned the corner in time to see a black Escalade continuing north on the forelane. I made a turn on a late yellow, drifted to the right, and pulled in behind a delivery van in the slow lane. Back at Dauphin, he stopped at the light, and we slowed behind the truck, but the light changed too quickly. Damn! Henry's eyes stayed on the black SUV.
What?
If he'd stopped at the light a little longer, I was going to get out. Yes, that worked so well last time. Vic was still hanging between the seats as I pulled around the step van and accelerated. The Cadillac made a left without hitting the turn signal, then a hard right on Strawberry Drive. I don't suppose either of you got the license number yet? I hung back at the turn, but it's hard to go unnoticed when you are a powder blue vintage convertible with a cowboy, an Indian, a brunette, and a dog inside. He had steadily accelerated as we approached the light at Strawberry Mansion Bridge, and by the time he got to the intersection, he was running a straight 60. Fortunately, the light was green, and we shot onto the ramp of the bridge about 90 feet behind him, barely missing a bicyclist who shook his fist at us. The 50-year-old steering on the Big Bird felt a little loose as we dropped over the Schuylkill Expressway and watched as the caddy continued to gain speed but easily make the corner at Greenland Drive. I hit the brakes a little as I turned the wheel, powered through the curve, and flattened the accelerator to the floor as the bulk of the cast-iron engine exploded internally, shooting us up the tree-lined thoroughfare at 80. I noticed that Vic had pulled my .45 from the pack. "There's a stop sign up here." I saw the Escalade blow through the sign with a squealing right and continue up the next street at full throttle. I looked over my left shoulder but couldn't see anything but the forest for the trees. We were committed, and I only hoped that our luck would hold as I kept the pedal to the classic metal. I had guessed we'd pushed our luck about as far as it would go when I saw the brand spanking new Grand Cherokee pulling the two-bay horse trailer just as we got to Shimoni Drive. I cut the wheel, and we dropped off the road, easily outrunning the laboring jeep and jumping the street. We missed an oncoming Volvo station wagon in the other lane, slid into the gravel approach to the stables, and clipped the sign as everybody blew their horns. I saw the jeep turn into the stables as we renegotiated the asphalt and straightened into our lane. I looked down the road ahead of us, but could see nothing.
"I cannot believe you just dented Lola."
I ignored him and slowed, asking over my shoulder, "Where does this go?" She slid the mechanism back on the semi-automatic. "It connects with Conshohocken Avenue, turning back where we came from, or down Falls Road in the expressway." I yelled over the engine and wind noise, "Which way would you go?" "Expressway!" We rounded the corner, drove behind a large mansion, and suddenly the point became moot. There were large sawhorses across the road that effectively blocked entry and declared in large black and orange letters, "Road closed due to construction." I hit the brakes, and we all looked at each other. Vic gestured with a chin. "Go on ahead around the circle and back down." I followed her directions and continued around and back onto the drive, where we could see straight down Shimoni. There was no Escalade. She gestured to the right, where an unlabeled road disappeared into the trees. "There." I made the turn and hit the throttle again. "Where does it go?" "Nowhere. It dead ends in about a quarter mile." I made a sweeping turn and looked down at a pastoral idyll. I could see the Cadillac backing up with the beginning of a three-point turn at the end of the road. I hit the gas and barreled down the two-lane drive with no name, rapidly coming up on the black caddy. He finished the turn and whipped the big vehicle straight at us. My nerves stayed steady as we approached each other at a climbing 60. Henry grabbed the dash.
"What if it is not William Whiteyes?"
Almost an answer, I felt and saw two things. The tinted side window on the caddy was down, and something was being thrust between the side-view mirror and the windshield. At the same time, I felt Vic rise and shoot just as the tick-tock compressed fire of a fully automatic weapon blistered the surface of the road in front of us and ripped its way up the front of the Thunderbird. I veered to the right as the windshield exploded, and I tried to yank Vic down by her leather jacket. The return fire of the big Colt had struck home, and I watched as the heavy slugs bit into the hood, windshield, and door of the Escalade as it rushed by us and glanced off the side of the T-Bird. I hit the brakes and turned the wheel, stretching our momentum into a sliding turn, but at least two of the tires were flat, and we warbled to a stop. The Escalade was about 50 yards back down the road. I threw the door open and pushed off from the side of the car. I'm not sure what I thought I was going to do without a sidearm, but I figured I'd think of something when I got there. I heard Dog barking and coming up fast behind me. In the reflection of the Cadillac's side mirror, I could see someone frantically attempting to do something and desperately hoped that he wasn't about to reload. I got about halfway there when Dog overtook me, and I yelled at him to come. The man in the Cadillac turned, roared the motor, sprayed grass and turf as he reached the curve, and was gone. I slowed to a stop and stood there in the middle of the road with the spent shells of the 9mm scattered across the pavement. I made a few silent vows to myself as my jaw muscles clenched and stretched at the sutures. Toy Diaz. Had to be. I placed my hands on my knees and attempted to catch my breath as Dog came over and stuck his nose in my face. My sides were killing me as I made the slow walk back to the T-Bird. I was dizzy, and I was sweating, and it seemed very hot as I looked up at the big convertible, which was stretched across the road. Henry was in the back, and I picked up my pace. There was blood on the white leather of the cavernous seat. A lot of blood. Henry had pulled her down, and had cradled her head while applying pressure to the wound with his shirt. One of the slugs from the assault rifle had caught her in the side, just under the arm at the oblique muscles. It was hard to say where else the slug had gone. I leaned in and looked at her tarnished gold eyes, which were already glazing with shock. She raised a blood-coated hand and smiled.
"Stop being weird."
Chapter 15. It was as bad as it looked, and maybe a little worse. The 9mm slug had taken a hard left where her love handle would have been if she'd had one, and a second had clipped her just above the collarbone and had taken a bit of the shoulder blade with it. My attempts at filling the available beds at the hospital of the University of Pennsylvania had not gone unnoticed, and Rissman had asked if I wanted all my people in one wing. I noted that it'd be convenient. I called the Moretti family, although Vic had told me not to, and sat down in the hallway to await the onslaught. Chavez had taken our statements. He said that Asa Katz would be here momentarily, but that Gowder was still being queried about the Shankar Duval shooting. "How's that going?" He shrugged and slipped the papers into his aluminum clipboard. "I'd put it down as a service to society, but you never know." Henry said he had a few loose ends to tie up, and that he'd be back in a couple of hours. I apologized for getting dents and bullet holes in Lola, but he didn't say anything. He took Dog, and I figured I was in deep trouble. I went up to Katie's to wait for Vic to get out of surgery, and found Joe Fitzpatrick sitting in a chair by my daughter's bed. Joe was incognito in jeans, a worn pair of rough-out boots, and a weathered Carhartt coat that looked familiar. They were deep in the throes of a one-sided conversation concerning the case of the Atlantic City Company that had attempted to do a little under-the-table trading. Evidently, the case had been transferred to Joe, and she was getting Katie up to speed, even if all my daughter could do was look at her while she talked and occasionally squeeze her hand. It was hard to breathe when I went into that room. "What happened to you?" I had a tendency to forget what I looked like as of late. I thought I might blend in better if I had a few more bandages. She looked at me doubtfully as I stepped to the other side of the bed and reached out to hold Katie's other hand. "How is she?" Katie squeezed back, and I watched as her eyes slowly tracked from Joe to me. I sighed and listened to my breath rattle as she squeezed my hand again.
"She's looking much better, don't you think?"
"Yep."
She waited a few moments before speaking again. "I had a little time this morning and thought I'd come over and help out."
"Thank you." I kept my eyes on Katie's, but hers had closed. I gently slipped my hand away. "Joe, do you mind if I ask you a question?" It was a slow response.
"I guess not."
"What would you say your firm's position is toward Katie?"
"I'm not sure I understand."
I swallowed. "I'm thinking of taking her back to Wyoming, and without the ability to consult with her in all this."
She stepped a little forward and into my line of sight, and I could see from the general attitude of her body that she was more relaxed. "Katie is one of the best lawyers in the firm."
Her voice broke a little, and I could hear the wind outside the windows and in between her words.
"David Calder, the senior partner, called me up to his office yesterday morning to make sure that we were doing everything we could for her."
When I glanced over, tears were on her face.
"He said that no matter what it took, and no matter how long it took, we were to be committed to Katie's recovery and her continued position in the firm."
I nodded and looked back at my daughter. "Then I think we're going to go back home."
"To Wyoming?"
She sounded a little relieved. "As soon as she can."
I squeezed Katie's hand again, but she was asleep.
"I've got a few things to attend to, and so does she.
I smiled and looked at the young lawyer on the other side of the bed.
"Can I ask you another question?"
She smiled back and wiped her face.
"Sure."
I waited. "Who assigns the pro bono cases at the firm?" She coughed and swallowed, wiped her eyes some more, and then cleared her throat, gesturing with her hand to explain the time it took to respond.
"That would be me."
I nodded. "You?"
"Yes."
I nodded some more. "So, you assigned William White Eyes to Katie?" She stayed steady.
"Yes."
"Joe?" I smiled again, just to let her know I wasn't going to jump over the bed and handcuff her, and went and sat in one of the chairs beside the window, thinking that maybe if I sat down, it would be easier for her. I picked up the book on the public art of Philadelphia. She didn't move, and her back was to me. "The way I figure it, Osgood pressured Devon.
I told them to not let Katie find out about any of this stuff."
I kept looking at the book. It was an old trick, but she didn't fall for it and stayed as she was. "Well, it looks like you were right." I waited, but she stayed silent. I flipped through the book to the section on Northwest Fairmount Park. "Where's Riley Elizabeth?" At that, she turned and looked at me.
"What?"
"I was wondering where your daughter is." I studied the book as she crossed to the other chair, sat, and folded her hands in her lap.
"My mother is taking care of her."
She turned her head and looked out the window. I took a deep breath and let out with a heavy exhale, attempting some comic relief, but probably sounding more like a tire going flat. William White Eyes wasn't supposed to get out.
"No."
I looked at Katie. "Leave it to the greatest legal mind of our time to mess up the appeal." I laughed, and Joe turned to look at me. Her hair hung back on her shoulder, providing a stark contrast to the cream-colored luster of her skin. I smiled at her. "You want to hear something funny?" She waited. "I partially believed you." I thought about it. It's pretty obvious that when Billy Carlisle went native, he became a problem. But when he met Katie, he took Devon and Vince Osgood into the liability column with him. I might be a problem for Diaz, but nothing on the level of Devon Conliffe, Vince Osgood, and worse yet, the now-named William White Eyes. I continued to look at Katie and interrogate Joe Fitzpatrick. "Did you know that Osgood was in business with Toy Diaz on Shankar Duval?"
"No."
I went back to the book and read about a statue near the Rex Avenue Bridge on Forbidden Drive, of all places. She didn't say anything more. "What more do you know about William White Eyes?"
"Nothing."
She had waited just a moment too long, so I gave her one more opportunity. "You're sure?" I listened as the severity of all the things I had told her settled like a sedimentary layer of criminal activity, making us both feel unclean. Her lips trembled and her mouth opened, but it took a long time for no words to come out. I looked at the waning afternoon sun as she quietly picked up her things and left.